You will be in even greater danger now, Mark.
I don't think so, General. I am under your protection, and he knows it.
God grant that it is enough, Sean muttered.
But what can we do against him?
How can we stop this?
Sean paused, seeking the word, and then hissed it savagely.
This monster.
There is no evidence, Mark said. Nothing to use against him. He has been too clever for that by far.
There is evidence, said Sean with complete certainty. If all this is true, then there is evidence. Somewhere.
Trojan the Mule's broad back felt like a barrel under Mark, and the sun beat through his shirt so that his sweat rose in dark, damp patches between his shoulder blades and at his armpits. As he jogged down the bank of the Bubezi with Spartan, the second heavily burdened mule, following him on a lead. In the riverbed on one of the sugary white sandbanks, he let the mules wade in knee-deep and begin to drink, sucking up the clear water noisily so that he could feel the animal's belly swelling between his knees. He pushed his hat back onto the back of his head and wiped away the drops from his brow with one thumb as he looked up at the portals of Sharka's Gate. They seemed to fall out of the sky like cascades of stone, sheer and eternal, so vast and solid that they dwarfed the land and the river at their feet. The double pannier on the back of the lead mule was the less onerous of the burdens that he had brought with him from the teeming reaches of civilization. He had brought also a load of guilt and remorse, the sorrow of a lost love, and the galling of duty left unperformed. But now, beneath the cliffs of Sharka's Gate, he felt his burden lightening and his shoulders gathering strength. Something indefinable seemed to reach out to him from across the Bubezi River, a feeling of destiny running its appointed course, or more, a sense of homecoming. Yes, he thought with sudden joy, I am coming home at last. Abruptly, Mark was in a hurry. He pulled up Trojan's reluctant head, with water still pouring from his loose, rubbery lips, and kicked him forward into the swirling green eddy of the river, slipping from the saddle to swim beside him when he lost his footing. As the big soup plate hooves touched the bottom, he threw his leg back across the saddle and rode up the far bank, his breeches clinging to his thighs and his sodden shirt streaming water. Suddenly, for the first time in a week, and for no good reason, he laughed, a light, unstrained burst of laughter that hung about him like a shimmering halo long afterwards. The sound was so low, and the hooves of Trojan, the grey mule, were plugging into the soft earth along the river with a rhythmic chuffing sound, so that Mark was not sure of what he had heard. He reined Trojan to a stop and listened. The silence was so complete that it seemed to hiss like static, and when a wood dove gave its melodious and melancholy whistle a mile along the river, it seemed close enough to touch. Mark shook his head and flicked the reins. At the first hoof-fall, the sound came again, and this time there was no mistaking it. The hair down the nape of Mark's neck prickled, and he straightened quickly out of his comfortable saddle slouch. He had heard that sound only once before, but in circumstances that made certain he would never forget it. It was close, very close, coming from the patch of thick green riverine bush between him and the river, a tangled thicket of wild loquat and hanging lianas, typical cover for the animal that had called. It was a weird, unearthly sound, a fluid sound, almost like liquor poured from the neck of a stone jug, and only one who had heard it before would recognize the distress and warning call of a fully grown leopard. Mark swung the mule away and set him lumbering up the rising ground until he reached the spreading shade of a leadwood, where he tethered him and loosened his girth. Then he slipped the Mannlicher out of its scabbard and quickly checked the loaded magazine. The fat brass cartridges, with their copper-jacketed noses, were still bright and slick with wax, and he snapped the bolt closed. He carried the rifle casually in his left hand, for he had no intention at all of using it. Instead, he was aware of a pleasurable glow of excitement and anticipation. In the 2 months of hard riding and walking since his return to Sharka's Gate, this was the first chance he had been given of sighting a leopard. There were many leopard along the Bubezi. He had seen their sign almost daily, and heard them sawing and coughing in the night,
Always the leopard and the kudu are the last to give way before man and his civilization. Their superior cunning and natural stealth protect them long after the other species have succumbed. Now he had a chance at a sighting. The patch of riverine bush, though dense, was small, and he longed for a sighting, even if just a flash of yellow in deep shade, something concrete, a firm entry in his logbook, another species to add to the growing list of his headcount. He circled out cautiously, his eyes flickering from the thick green wall of bush to soft ground at his feet, checking for spoor as well as for actual sight of the yellow cat. Just above the steep river bank, he stopped abruptly and stared down before going onto one knee to touch the earth. They weren't leopard tracks, but others he had grown to know and recognize. There was no special distinguishing characteristic, no missing toes, no scarring or deformity, but Mark's trained eye recognized the shape and size, the slight splaying toe-in way the man walked, the length of his stride and a toe-heavy impression, that of a quick, alert tread. The distress call of the animal in the thicket made sense now. "Pungoshi," said Mark quietly. "The jackal at work again." The tracks were doubled, entering the thicket and returning. The inward tracks seemed deeper, less extended, as though the man carried a burden. But the outward tracks were lighter. The man walked freely. Slowly, Mark edged in towards the thicket, following the man's prints, pausing for long minutes to examine the undergrowth carefully every few paces, or squatting down to give himself better vision along the ground under the hanging lianas and branches. Now that he knew what he was going to find, the pleasurable glow of excitement had given way to the chill of anger and the cold knowledge of mortal danger. Something white caught his eye in the gloomy depths of the thicket. He stared at it moments before he saw the white, bleeding pith of a tree trunk, where it had been ripped by the claws of an anguished beast, long raking marks deep through the dark woody bark. His anger slid in his belly like an uncoiling serpent. He moved sideways and slowly forward, the rifle held ready now, low across his hips, 3 paces before he stopped again. On the edge of the thicket there was an area of flattened grass and scrub. The soft black leaf mould earth had been churned and disturbed. Something heavy had been dragged back and forth, and there was a fleck of wet red lit by a single beam of falling sunlight that might have been the petal of a wild flower, or a drop of blood. He heard another sound then, the clink of metal on metal, link on link. Steel chain moved stealthily in the dark depths of the thicket, and it sighted him. He knew where the animal was lying now, and he moved out sideways, crabbing step after step, slipping the safety catch of the rifle and holding it at high port across his chest. White again, unnatural white, a round blob of it against dark foliage, and he froze staring at it. Long seconds passed before he realized that it was the raw wood of a cut log, a short, fork-shaped log as thick as a young girl's waist, so freshly cut that the gum was still bleeding from it, in sticky, wine-coloured drops. He saw also the twist of stolen fencing wire that held the chain to the log. The log was the anchor, a sliding drag weight which would hold the trapped animal without giving it a solid pull against which to pit itself and tear itself free. The chain clinked again. The leopard was within 20 paces of him. He knew exactly where it was, but he could not see it, and as he stared his mind was racing, remembering everything he had heard about the animal, the old man's stories. "You won't see him until he comes, and even then he will only be a yellow flash of light, like a sunbeam. He won't warn you with a grunt, not like a lion. He comes absolutely silently, and he won't chew your arm or grab you in the shoulder. He'll go for your head. He knows all about two-legged animals. He feeds mostly on baboon, so he knows where your head is. He'll take the top off your skull quicker than you open your breakfast egg, and for good measure his back legs will be busy on your belly. You've seen a cat lie on his back and hook with his back legs when you scratch his belly. He'll catch you the same way, but he'll strip your guts out just like you're a chicken, and he'll do it so quickly that if there are 4 of you in the hunting party, he'll kill 3 of them before the 4th man gets his gun to his shoulder." Mark stood absolutely still and waited. He could not see the animal, but he could feel it, could feel its eyes. They stung his skin like the feet of poisonous crawling insects. And he remembered the shiny marble white scar tissue that Sean Courtney had shown him once, in one of those mellow moments after the fourth whiskey, pulling up his shirt and flexing muscle, so the cicatrice bulged with the gloss of satin. "Leopard," he'd said. "Devil cat. The worst bastard in all the bush." He felt his feet pulling back slowly, and the dead leaves rustled. He could walk away and leave it, come back when the vultures told him the animal was dead or too weak to be a danger. Then he imagined the terror and anguish of the animal, and suddenly it was not the animal, but his animal, his charge, his sacred charge. And he stepped forward. The chain clinked again, and the leopard came. It came with a terrible silent rush, and in the blurring, streaming charge only the eyes blazed. They blazed yellow with hatred and fear and agony. The chain flailed out behind it, spinning and snapping, and as Mark brought the rifle up the last 6 inches to his shoulder, he saw the strap hanging on its foreleg like a sinister grey metallic crab. The heavy steel trap slowed the charge just that fraction. Time seemed to pass with a dreamlike slowness, each microsecond falling heavily as drops of thick oil, so that he saw that the leopard's foreleg above the grip of the steel jaws was eaten through. He felt his stomach turn over as he realized that the frenzied animal had gnawed through its own bone and flesh and sinew in its desperate try for freedom. The leg was held by only a thread of bloody, ragged skin, and that last thread snapped at the heavy jerk of the steel trap. The leopard was free, mad with pain and fear, as it launched itself at Mark's head. The muzzle of the Mannlicher almost touched the broad, flat forehead. He was so close that he could see the long white whiskers bristling from the puckered, snarling lips like grass stalks stiff with the morning frost, and the yellow fangs behind wet black lips, the furry pink tongue arched across the open throat, and the eyes, the terrible, hating yellow eyes. Mark fired, and the bullet clubbed the skull open. The yellow eyes blinked tightly at the jarring shock, and the head was wrenched backwards, twisted on the snake-like neck, while the lithe body lost its grace and lightness and turned heavy and shapeless in midair. It felt like a sack at Mark's feet, and tiny droplets of brilliant red blood spat at the scuffed toe-cap of Mark's boot and glittered there like cut rubies. Mark touched the open, staring eye, but the fierce yellow light was fading, and there was no blinking reflex of the eyelids with their long, beautiful fans of dark lashes. The leopard was dead, and Mark sat down heavily in the leaf mould beside the carcass and groped for his cigarette tin. The hand that held the match shook so violently that the flame fluttered like a moth's wing. He shook out the flame, threw the match away, and then stroked his open palm across the soft, thick fur, the amber gold dabbed with the distinctive rosettes of black, as though touched by the five bunched fingertips of an angel's right hand. "Pungushi, you bastard," he whispered again. The animal had died for that golden dappled hide, for the few silver shillings that it would bring when sold in the village market, at a country railway halt, or on the side of a dusty road. A death in unspeakable agony and terror to make a rug, or a coat for a lady. Mark stroked the glowing fur again, and felt his own fear give way to anger for the man who had saved his life once, and who he had hunted these 2 months.